she think I just gave her the nod? Call the meeting of the Subcommittee on Elections of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee to order. My name is Dan Larson. I'm the chair of the Election Subcommittee, and thank all of you for being here today. Senator Gimsey, thank you. It's good to see you again. Senator Rest, who is the chair of our full committee, is in two meetings here today, so she will be it was here earlier and will be checking in periodically, and we have a couple of other members that will be joining us as well that are on our subcommittee that that are on their way to the hearing. So we look forward to a good discussion here today regarding ranked voting, discussion we've been looking forward to having for quite some time. And I think we're going to get started because we have such a full agenda. And so we will begin with Gene Massey, Executive Director of Fair Vote Minnesota. And, Ms. Massey, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Members of the committee, my name is Jean Massey, and I'm the Executive Director of Fair Vote Minnesota. I was also a lead organizer for the campaign for instant runoff voting in Minneapolis last year, and that passed on the ballot 2-1 in November of last year. Thank you for inviting me to share about instant runoff voting, what we now are calling ranked choice voting, on the Secretary of State's issues group. My role today is to share with you what instant runoff voting is about, what problems it addresses in the election system, and how it works. And I'm pleased that John Gilbert is here from North Carolina, where they have used instant runoff voting now in two pilot cities as a part of a legislative pilot program in this past election season, and he'll be reporting on the experience there in the use of instant runoff voting in those two cities. So what I'm going to do is just walk through some of the basics about ranked choice voting, instant runoff voting, on a PowerPoint presentation, and I'll be available to help answer questions at the close of the session. Can everybody see that okay? Yeah. All right, thank you. All right. Well, first I want to simply define what ranked choice voting is, or instant runoff voting. It's an electoral reform, one of many election reforms that make an effort at trying to ensure that there is greater voter participation and maximizing voter effectiveness. And it's simply a ranked ballot form of voting that simulates a runoff in a single election. In doing that, it ensures majority winners and proportional representation. And again, all doing that in a single election. And you can see here what the ballot looks like. You simply mark candidates in order of preference, first, second, third choice on the ballot. It's a solution to many problems in our current voting system. I'm going to highlight what three key issues are that ranked choice voting helps to address. The first is minority winners. We often have elections when we don't have a majority winner requirement, with winners winning with less than a majority of support. And that's most typical in state elections or open seat primary elections. And if we look back at the gubernatorial races, for example, we can see that the candidates win with less than a majority of support, and that happens in many other elections as well. We have expensive low turnout primaries, especially in local nonpartisan elections, whereby we have two rounds of elections and voters turn out in much greater numbers in general elections and far fewer numbers in primary elections. With ranked choice vote, and we can combine the two elections and accomplish a majority winner in the single election. And then lastly, we have disproportional representation in our at-large elections, whereby when we have multi-seat elections, it's not uncommon whereby a very small group of voters can determine most or all of the candidates who win. So I'm going to walk through some of those problems and how ranked choice voting helps address them. First, in a single winner election, a candidate needs 50% plus one vote to win a majority. And this isn't a problem if there are just two candidates on the ballot. But that's decreasingly the case in statewide elections. And where there are multiple candidates running, the winner can be elected without winning a majority. And I went through the examples before. So someone could win with 40% of the vote or less of the vote. In a single winner election, a candidate again needs a majority of votes or 50% plus one vote to win by majority. How is that threshold arrived at? Very simply, the formula, and this is the ranked choice voting, instant runoff voting formula, it's 1 over the number of seats to fill plus 1, and that's 1/2 plus 1 vote. So that's the basic formula for ranked choice voting, the single transferable vote form of ranked choice voting. I'm going to describe briefly how we count the votes using ranked choice voting. First, you count up all first choices on the ballot. If there's no candidate with a majority of first choices, the candidate with the fewest votes is defeated, and those votes then go on to the second choices on each ballot. The votes are recounted, and the process continues until one candidate achieves the required majority. And I'll go through a graphic example of this for those who may be less familiar with this concept. Again, we ask the question, does any candidate reach the threshold? And here we have Ernie, Bert, Grover, and Zoe. you're all familiar with who the candidates are. None of whom achieved a majority of support on the first ballot. So what we do is we eliminate the candidate who comes in last. That's Bert. He was the least popular of first choice votes. And then we redistribute the ballots of the votes who voted for Bert to the candidates on the ballots for second choices. So of the 15 people who voted for Bert in first place, 6 cast a second place vote for Ernie, 4 for Grover, and 5 for Zoe. Again, we go through another round of counting, and we ask the question, did anyone achieve a majority? No, so we need to eliminate the second, the candidate who is in last place on this round, and that's Ernie. And once we redistribute his votes, we see that we have a majority winner, and that's Zoe. Zoe won the election. And you can see that she won because of the runoff process. Again, this is simply a runoff, and I want to be clear about this. It's everyone has one vote and one vote only in each round of counting, and the purpose of ranking candidates as opposed to coming back to a second election to have a runoff is that it's a lot more convenient and less expensive to do it in a single election. And if we just compare it to how we do two-round elections now, in local elections, we winnow down candidates in a primary, so we have a primary election and a general election. And if I go to the primary and cast a vote for my preferred candidate, but if my candidate doesn't make it through the primary, then I go back to the general election and cast a vote for my second choice. And if I don't want to rank a second choice in the ballot, then it would be like not going back to the general election. Now, if we had instant runoff voting in state elections and we institute a majority winner requirement, then we could use this system to ensure a majority winner without adding a separate runoff election, for example, in December, which is done in some states. So that's that's how that works in a single seat race. So some of the benefits of ranked choice voting. It ensures a majority winner in one election, which I made clear, and that's when voter turnout is highest. And if we look at the example of the turnout in St. Paul and the historical trend, we can see how low voter participation is in the primary relative to the general election. So it maximizes voter participation in the decisive election. So there's no need for primary in a local nonpartisan race, and there would be no need for a post-election runoff in state partisan elections. It saves taxpayers and candidates money who don't have to pay for two elections or run for two campaigns. Voters can vote for their preferred candidate without fear of helping elect their least preferred candidate, which is often the situation when you don't have a majority winner requirement. It frees minor parties from being cast as spoilers in an election and allows them to gain an accurate measure of voter support. And it tends to reduce negative campaigning and keep campaigns more focused on issues. Now, multi-winner elections, in a race where there are multiple seats to fill, a small share of voters can gain a disproportionate share of representation. With ranked choice voting, it ensures that all voters are represented in proportion to their voting strength. So it ensures that the majority rules, but it also ensures representation by minority voting populations. Again, you complete the ballot just like you would in a single-seat election, but the share of votes needed to win is lower than 50% plus one because there are more seats to fill. So using the same formula that I showed before on a single-seat race, we simply divide the 1 over the number of seats to fill plus 1 vote. So if it's a two-election seat, the candidate needs to win 33% of the vote plus 1 in order to win for a three-seat election 25% and for a four-seat election 20%. And the vote counting process works a little bit differently because we have more seats to fill. So you count first choices. If a candidate gets more votes than needed to win, these votes are proportionally redistributed to next choice candidates on each ballot rather than being wasted. When there are no candidates with more votes than needed to win, the candidate with the fewest votes is eliminated, and those votes for the candidate go to the next choice on each ballot. The process repeats until all seats have been filled. And I can go through an example of this, and you should have some handouts available to you, too. I'll ask for a time check, though. It'll take me maybe 3 more minutes to get through the example if you would like me to do that.
That's fine.
Sure.
Please proceed.
Thank you. All right. So this is an example of filling two seats at once. There are 4 candidates running to fill 2 seats on the board of really smart people in hometown Minnesota. 10,000 votes were cast, so how many votes does a candidate need to win the winning threshold? You have the number of seats over the number of votes divided by the number of seats plus 1, so 10,000 votes divided by the number of seats plus 1, that's 3,330 votes needed to win in order to fill a seat. So the candidates running again are Ernie, Bert, Zoe, and Grover. Ernie is the candidate who's most popular, in fact, so popular he won more votes than needed to win. He won 666 more votes than needed to win, and those are surplus votes. And rather than wasting them, we can use them. So it's kind of like taking a dollar to the store and getting change back and continuing to spend to use that power. So Ernie is seated. He won one of the seats, and we take the 666 votes, and we redistribute them to second place votes on each of the ballots at a fractional level so that we make sure that a part of each person's vote is transferred to their second choices. And there's a formula for how to do that, and I won't go into great length about that, but it's in the handout that I gave you. It's simply the total votes minus the total votes he received less the votes that were needed to win over the total votes, and that's 16%. So you times 16% by all of the votes that were transferred, and we redistribute then 499 votes to Zoe and 166 votes to Grover. Grover is in last. So we ask the question again, did anyone reach the threshold for winning? The answer is no. So in this case, there are no surplus votes to redistribute, so we eliminate from the bottom, that would be Grover, and we distribute, in this case, whole votes, Grover's votes to remaining candidates. And in this case, then, 1,000 were cast to Zoe and 166 to Bert, and that put Zoe up to the threshold or over the threshold level, and Zoe won as a result of those transferred votes. What this does is, with ranked choice voting, all votes, not just the most voters, help elect the winners. And that's how we gain proportional representation. And I just want to highlight that there are methods of voting in multi-seat elections that essentially treat each candidate as a single seat or each seat as a single seat. And you can, with a ranked ballot, then achieve a majority winner for each of those seats. And that was the type of voting that was used in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and the type of model that Hopkins is also considering. So I'll close with this, and if you want to ask any questions now, I can remain here or
Thank you.
Let others speak.
Thank you, Ms. Massey. Are there questions from members? I also want to mention for the audience that Senator Gerlach has joined us and Senator Pappas has joined us. Thank you as well. And members, I would also point out that in your packets there is a frequently asked questions from FairVote that they had distributed that should be in your packet, as well as a copy of the PowerPoint. In addition to that, before we ask Mr. Gilbert to come forward to give us testimony regarding his experience in North Carolina, you also should have in your packet testimony from Terry Barishas, a former Vermont legislator, who sent written testimony. Mr. Richard DeLeon, a professor emeritus of political science at San Francisco State University, regarding IRV in San Francisco. And George Governman, an attorney in private practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts, regarding their experience in Cambridge. With that, thank you, Ms. Massey, very much for
Mr.
a good
Chair.
Description.
Questions or
questions? Can I ask
Was she open for questions?
Sir, excuse me.
I thought I was wondering if she was open for questions. I thought that's what I heard.
The chair will recognize members of the public just for everyone's purposes of knowing how we'll proceed with the hearing. We've had people have signed up to testify, and that's our process for by which the public will provide testimony. We've received a lot of requests for that. We're going to proceed. It appears that Senator Gerlach has a question, and Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a few questions, so thank you, Ms. Massey, for coming. This issue I first became aware of actually when Bruce in the back row came to my office a number of years ago and with his laptop presentation, and it was the first I had heard of it, and it was interesting on the surface, but I have a lot of questions and issues with this, with the process, and a few of them. I know we're going to get a lot of testimony, a lot of ones, but I just wanted to toss out a couple. First question is, you mentioned that the system would yield less negative campaigns. How would that be? What is the basis of that, the assertion that instant runoff voting would lead to less negative campaigning? I'm just curious on how it would achieve that.
Ms. Massey.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, the incentive that candidates have under instant runoff voting is to appeal to second choice votes as well as first choice votes. So candidates need to attract as many first-choice votes as possible, campaign for that, but also don't want to alienate voters in the hope that they may identify them as second-place votes. So it tends to have a very different effect on the way that the campaigns happen. And, in fact, in San Francisco, when this was first implemented in 2004, it made headline news, the difference in the nature of the campaigning. And that was also true in Burlington when it was first used last year for the election of mayor. So it does have an impact. It doesn't ameliorate all negative campaigning, but it has a definite impact on the nature of the campaigning.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious on what is on the thresholds. Right now, in our current system, you can be elected with a plurality. This system, instant runoff voting, seeks a majority of 50% plus one. Of course, there are certain things that require supermajorities in the legislature. We have certain votes that require supermajorities and such, and all these different thresholds are designed to have certain or different results or achieving a greater consensus. Why is the holy grail on instant runoff voting 50% plus one or a majority? Why wouldn't we have even better democracy if we had 60% or a supermajority? We can run the calculation to its natural conclusion, and I think we could probably even get it to a 100% consensus if we kept running the formula. Why do we stop at 50%? Is that an arbitrary feeling number of saying, well, it ought to be a majority? Where does the number come from?
Ms. Massey.
Mr. Chair, well, no, the formula for single transferable vote is what I had showed you mathematically, but the principle behind a majority winner election is to simply uphold the democratic principle of being supported by the majority. Now, if we were to ascend that and try to reach supermajority in each of the elections, that may be a more complicated matter, but minimally, whoever governs has the mandate of the majority, most of the voters, and not a minority of the voters. And this is accomplished in a single election. That is the purpose of a runoff, is to get the acquired majority. But with with instant runoff voting, we can do that in one election.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach.
I know that Abraham Lincoln was elected with a plurality. I guess maybe the country would have turned out a lot differently if we had had instant runoff voting computers than to calculate that, but I don't know that that was being a northern state. I don't think that was a bad election result, but it was a plurality and not a majority. Ms. Massey, one of the elements of instant runoff voting is to sort of, to combine the primary and the general elections together. The assertions of saving money and such and making things be smoother. What is Fair Vote Minnesota's view on the purpose of a party's primary election? What is the purpose? What purpose does a primary election serve?
Ms. Massey.
Mr. Chair, I'll distinguish between local nonpartisan races and state partisan races. The ability to combine an election in a local election is because they're nonpartisan, and the purpose of a primary is to winnow down, not elect a partisan candidate. So in those circumstances, with ranked choice voting, the two elections can be combined and achieve a majority winner on the single ballot. In a state election, the primary would still remain in place, and ranked choice voting could be used in the primary to elect a majority candidate from each party. That would be a choice that would need to be made at the time of considering this reform. Ranked choice voting would not eliminate a partisan primary. So partisan primary would be used to select a partisan candidate, and then the partisan candidates appearing on the general election ballot, and ranked choice voting used then to elect a majority winner in each of those races.
Okay. That clears up my question, because I was under the impression that partisan primaries and general elections would all be put together, and that didn't make sense to me, since you want to select a party's candidate, so that makes sense. Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the questions that I have right now, but I know that we're going to probably have a lengthier discussion about the constitutionality and all those issues, I'm sure, are going to be coming up, and I can ask some more questions at that time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. We have a lot of people that have signed up to testify. I think we'll have a full discussion throughout covering many facets of the issue. But so I think we'll move forward to hear from Mr. John Gilbert. And thank you, Ms. Massey,
thank you very much.
Mr. Gilbert, we welcome here from North Carolina. And Mr. Gilbert is the chair of the Wake County Board of Elections, and we appreciate your coming to visit us here in Minnesota and share your experiences. Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. I am the chairman of the Wake County Board of Elections, which is located in Raleigh, capital city. I should hasten to add that it's also the home of North Carolina State University, where I taught political science for 40 years, but I am not here as an expert on instant runoff voting. I'm here as an elections board chairman for the last 6 years, and who's had some experience with conducting instant runoff voting elections. My specialty in political science was foreign policy, so I'm not an expert on voting per se. I think the most efficient way for me to offer some information which the committee may find useful about our experience with instant runoff voting is to simply address certain specific questions that I've been asked to talk about. When and why did the North Carolina legislature adopt legislation to pilot instant runoff voting? The North Carolina General Assembly passed the IRV law in 2006, authorizing the state board to use instant runoff voting with the consent of the local boards, the county boards of elections, and to use it in up to 10 municipalities during the current year and up to 10 counties next year. The state board was charged by the legislature to closely monitor the pilot programs and to report back to the General Assembly with its findings and recommendations, which I assume will happen after the election cycle next year. Two towns used IRV in 2007. Cary, with a population of 112,000, is a suburb of Raleigh, and Hendersonville, a town of about 12,000 up in the mountains in the western part of the state. Cary had single-seat elections for mayor and town council and used the optical scan machines, the same one I understand you use here in Minneapolis, the M100. Hendersonville had a multi-seat at-large council race along with single seats and the mayoral race, and they used direct record machines. The legislation also authorized IRV in statewide judicial races next year in certain special circumstances. We elect in nonpartisan elections our appellate court judges in North Carolina. And we had the circumstance 2 years ago, or 3 years ago in 2004, of a seat coming vacant as a result of the death of a Supreme Court member. After the primaries were over, but more than 60 days before the general election. So what the legislature did in this, the IRV authorizing legislation, was say that in the event that happens again, the instant runoff voting will be used in the election, because what happened in 2004 was what we had done previously in judicial elections was in both the Republican and Democratic primaries, the back of the ballot contained judicial races, which were nonpartisan. Voters who were registered as independents or unaffiliated with a party were given a separate ballot that contained only the nonpartisan races. And then the results of the of those ballots in both primaries and the independents was aggregated, and the top two candidates were on the ballot for the seat in November. Well, when we had the death, and what we had ended up with was a free-for-all election. There were eight candidates, and actually the gentleman who was elected to the Supreme Court only got 23% of the vote. So the legislature determined it would be a good idea to pilot IRV in circumstances like that. I believe the legislature was also influenced by the fact that in 2004, in both party primaries, we had an interesting situation. In the Democratic primary, we have a long ballot in North Carolina. We elect everybody but dog catcher. We, among other offices, we elect a superintendent of public instruction in a statewide election. In the Democratic primary, there were three candidates who, there were actually four candidates in the race, but the top three more or less evenly divided the vote, 30-30-30, slightly over 30% in two of the cases, 29%, I believe, in the other. And the result was that a month later we had a runoff primary with the top two candidates. The turnout was 3%, slightly less than 3% in the runoff. And it cost all of the precincts, of course, had to be open. And it cost the state, or actually cost the counties, who in North Carolina pay for opening the precincts, about $3.5 million. So we had a result that nobody could be confident represented the views of the majority of the voters in the Democratic primary. and it was very costly. In the Republican case, there were six candidates for governor, and they would have had a runoff. Of course, the votes were pretty widely dispersed. In that case, the candidate who came in second and was entitled to call for a runoff decided not to, so it saved what might have been a serious problem in that primary. Those were the things that I think motivated the General Assembly. Why did our board?
Do you recall what the vote the generally what the vote split was in that circumstance? That the second place finisher
and the Republicans.
Yeah.
It was. I don't, Senator Larson. It was. I could get you that information, but it was fairly close. I think the political wisdom among the insiders was that the calling for a runoff that the number two person likely would not have won the runoff, and I think he probably came to that conclusion himself, which is why he didn't call for a runoff. But it was pretty. There were six candidates, and several of them were quite credible candidates. So there was quite a distribution of the vote. Our board chose to become a pilot and to encourage the town of Cary to participate because. Well, let me just say I'm rather proud of the fact that while boards of election members in North Carolina are nominated, are recommended by their political parties, and in the case of the state board, they're appointed by the governor, who appoints three members of his own party and two members of the other party, but in both cases on the recommendations of the parties. And at the county level, we have three-member boards. And again, two members reflect the party registration of the governor and the other member of the other party. But again, they're recommended by their parties. But we have a long tradition in Wake County, which I'm quite proud, that we conduct elections in a nonpartisan way. The Board of Elections, just to illustrate the point, we've had hundreds of votes, maybe thousands of votes, to determine such things as whether or not a voter was entitled to cast the ballot that he cast, or if he was entitled to cast it, what part of it could be counted if he voted out of precinct, or what the intent of the voter was. If some of you may be, if you've ever worked a precinct or been involved in counting votes, you know that voters can get very creative in how they mark a ballot. We have not ever had a split vote on our Board of Elections in making those kinds of fundamental decisions. We've had, we've had only two split votes, and one of them was along party lines, the other one wasn't, but neither of them over the past 6 years were partisan. The positions of people on both sides of the issue in both of those two cases were quite reasonable positions. Reasonable people could disagree, but our board basically has two objectives. The first and most important is to be sure that the election is conducted with absolute integrity. That the votes are accurately counted, and that the people of the county, the citizens, have confidence that that is the case. And the second objective is to do everything that we can within our limited authority to facilitate voting by every citizen. We are proud of the fact, Senator, that in 2004, while at that time Charlotte, which is the largest city in North Carolina, and in Mecklenburg County, Charlotte and Mecklenburg had 40,000 more registered voters than we had in Wake County, but we outvoted them. we pass out provisional ballots very generously. If somebody comes to the polling place, because we have discovered over the years that about 75% of the people who come and ask for a provisional ballot are people who have simply moved within the county, and they haven't informed the Board of Elections, but they are entitled to vote. And if they vote in a race they weren't entitled to vote for, where the say a House district, then we just don't count it. We count partial ballots. If they were entitled to vote for president, they were entitled to vote for governor, and so on. So those are our two objectives. And if those are your objectives, whether as a legislator or a member of a board of elections, I think writing laws and designing processes is not rocket science. If those two principles are guiding you, that you want to maximize bringing us as close as we can be to government by consent of the governed, you can do that. You can write laws that will help us get to that. What did we learn from? I will elaborate at the proper time in the question period, if you would like me to, on why we think IRV offers an opportunity to bring us closer to government by consent of the governed. What did we learn from implementing IRV in Cary in October? Well, I believe that the election proved that IRV is as easy as 1, 2, 3, which was our not very original slogan in our educational campaign to educate people about the new ballot style. In the end, the rankings only affected one race in Cary. In the at-large race, one candidate won a solid majority. In the mayoral race, there were only two candidates, so wasn't an issue. And in the district races, there were two opportunities for IRV to kick in, but it did in only one case. And in that case, it did decide the winner. The voters had no difficulty with the ballot. And the town saved the $28,000 it would have cost otherwise to have opened the precincts in that district. If it had been an at-large, it would have been $62,000. In Hendersonville, 2 weeks ago today, where they used the IRV ballot instead of their usual plurality voting system, in their case, they didn't have runoffs. It was, just the first candidate across the line. Whoever got the most votes, even if it was, 23%, as the judge got in 2004, it was elected. They decided to pilot IRV, and in their case, they did have the more complicating factor of that you have, frankly, if you vote for multiple candidates in one seat. So, Gene described that it is a complicating factor. The way Hendersonville dealt with that, by the way, was a fairly simple solution, I thought. What they did was they used a direct record machine, and when on the first screen for the at-large multiple-seat race, what came up was a request to the voter, direction to the voter, that if the voter wished to vote for two, and there were two seats they could vote for, if the voter wished to vote for two, of course the voter could do so, and if the voter wished to rank those two, if he preferred Bert over Ernie, he would rank them on that screen. And on the next screen, he would be asked again if he wanted. Obviously, a voter can do anything he wants to, including voting a blank ballot. But if he wanted to rank his second choices, that's where he did it, on the second screen. As it turned out, in the event, all of the candidates on the ballot in Hendersonville won outright. So actually, instant runoff voting did not come into play there. In both cases, however, I think we learned a good deal from the exit polls that were commissioned by the state board and which were conducted in both Hendersonville and in Cary. And what we learned, frankly, and I've distributed the exit polls, I gave the chairman copies of the exit polls that were done by some university people under the direction of the state board. And what the exit polls briefly did was confirm the same thing that was learned in San Francisco from exit polls, and Burlington from exit polls, and from Tacoma Park, Maryland, in exit polls, and that is that the great majority of the voters had no trouble understanding ranked choice voting, or IRV. It is the opponents of it, frankly, insisted in Cary, and they have elsewhere, that it's too complicated, the voters won't understand it. It's not complicated. It doesn't have to be. It is as simple as 1, 2, 3, where people are accustomed to making choices. And we start when we're preschool making choices. And that's what ranked choice voting allows you to do. You make choices. You have your first choice, a second choice, a third choice, however many you want. That's up to, you know, that it varies. But what our exit polls confirmed was the same thing exit polls everywhere have confirmed. The voters like it, they understand it, and they didn't have any trouble executing it. And that applied across all kinds of groups, by ethnicity, by level of income, where they lived. It didn't seem to matter.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert. Members, I think the document that Mr. Gilbert is referring to is this document that should be in your packet. I believe we ran copies and got those into your packet. Again, we appreciate your coming to visit with us today, and also I know that we would want to thank FairVote, who made arrangements for you to be here today. Senator Gerlach, question?
I'm not going to ask that one. I have a different one.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. My question is that you concluded your statements with that it's very simple, that people understand it. 1, 2, 3, you rank the choices there. And I agree with that. When a voter goes to the poll, it's very simple on the front end to say, rank your choices. And they understand that. If you ask them, did you understand that process, they're going to say yes. But then the next question is, okay, now, behind the scenes, what happens with those choices and the manipulation of the data and the formulas? We saw the presentation with the different charts and the formulas and all of those calculations, which actually then determines the results. So that what happens behind the scenes of the data, if you ask the general populace within your jurisdiction, well, do you understand how your simple choice then is translated into a victor in this election? How many of them do you think they would say, oh, I understand how that works?
Probably about the same percentage as would answer a question about how we elect presidents in this country. Damn few of them, excuse me, really could tell you with specificity how we do that. Very few could. I know that as a political scientist. I don't have expertise on IRB, but I know that. If you look at it, I was sitting thinking, watching the PowerPoint presentation. Boy, I understood it, but it does make it look complicated, Senator. I agree with your suggestion, but it really isn't complicated. And by the way, there are different ways of tabulating. One way. Ms. Massey illustrated, but in what we did in Cary, for example, was simply We counted the votes by hand because while the technology exists to program the M100 to do the counting for you, we used it simply to determine the first choice. And the allocating the IRV race after that, we did by hand. But we did it in less than 2 hours, and it was, not difficult. What we did simply was divide the ballots into piles. We put all of the first choice ballots, and so it was clear who the two top choices were. We put their ballots in one pile. In a second pile, we put the ballots that were where neither of the top two candidates were the first choice, put those in a second pile, and in the third pile, we simply put the rest of the ballots. That is, ballots. Voters that voted for Mickey Mouse or voted a blank ballot or, everything else. Very small pile. And then we went, after we did that, we went to the second pile and we looked at the second choice of those who had not voted for either of the top two candidates. And then we allocated those second choices. It's very simple. And what people I often don't understand when they first hear about instant runoff voting is that their second choice can never be the enemy of their first choice, with one exception. If you have a multiple seat election and you don't do something like Hendersonville did, say, okay, first rank your top two choices so that you won't have a situation where if you really prefer Burt strongly over Ernie, they're your two choices for the two seats, but you like Burt a lot more than you like Ernie, then you rank them. And so on the second screen where you rank your choices, you're never going to have the situation where somebody games the system, As people game it now in multiple seats with what's called bullet voting or if you single shot, that's gaming the system. But you can defeat that, Senator Gerlach. It's not difficult to design a system that's very simple and will bring you closest to majority rule.
Senator Gerlach, I think you had a follow-up question or another question, and then if we could have a brief answer to that, then we're going to move to the next testimony. Well, Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up, and Mr. Gilbert, in North Carolina, you must have the same challenges with your civics education as we do in Minnesota and everywhere else in the country. But I would beg to differ. I think that a far more people understand that a state, when they cast their votes for president, you have electoral votes, and we see the maps on the news and the colors, and we at least can count up the electoral votes. And I think people have a general understanding of that. But you're probably correct in that they don't understand the minutia of detail. But clearly, with instant runoff voting, once you cast those simple upfront ranked choices, the amount of gymnastics that has to be done on the back end makes it so that if you tried to explain that would clearly confuse 90%+ of the I'll get some head shakes in the audience too, but clearly confuse most people, far more complicated than maybe you're letting on to believe, at least on the back end of the calculations. And that's my point. I guess it's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer that, but yeah. I'm responding to your assertion. But
And Senator Gerlach, I think that might be a good opportunity for us to segue to our next testimony, which will come from the city of Minneapolis. We, of course, know that in 2005 the city went through a great debate over a charter amendment regarding instant runoff voting. They no doubt can tell us about how much detail they went into in terms of having that discussion. I recall it frankly fairly well in terms of the discussion around town was one of the top discussions. And it's a good question: how much detail do people understand? And I think that as we take a look at ranked choice voting in the future, I think that's going to be one of the key questions. Is it something the public can understand, both on the front end conceptually, and then do they understand the details? And Mr. Gilbert, I'll just give you just a second to wrap up, and
I just
want to thank you for
coming. I just want to make one last observation, Senator. Thank you very much. And I meant to make it earlier, and I didn't, but I think it's a point worth stressing. Instant runoff voting is not a left-right issue. It is not a Democratic-Republican issue. It is simply an issue of if you believe in government by consent of the governed, if you believe, as E.B. White put it, that democracy is the recurring suspicion that more than half the people are right more than half the time, if you believe in that, then instant runoff voting gives you a way to get there. It is not partisan. It wasn't. It was adopted by a bipartisan vote in our legislature. As I said, our vote, our board was certainly unanimous in believing that we needed to take a look at it, to pilot it. And it's simply because we do believe that it brings us closer to government by consent of the government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert. Appreciate it very much. Members will now ask representatives of the City of Minneapolis. I know that Cindy Reichert, who is the Director of Elections and for the city, and Council Member Betsy Hodges are here to join us and are going to provide just kind of a brief update, if you can, about where things are at in Minneapolis. Council Member Hodges.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking the time on this issue today. I'm proud to be here as a pioneer from the City of Minneapolis on ranked choice voting. And indeed, we did talk to our voters about ranked choice voting. As a city council, the process we went through was we voted as a council to put the option of ranked choice voting on the ballot for our voters to discuss. And so it went to the full voting membership of Minneapolis, all of our residents, and they decided, I believe with 65, we decided with about 65% of the vote that indeed we wanted to implement ranked choice voting for our municipal elections. And so that will, Ms. Reichert will talk more about the process of implementing that at the city. But what I was pleased to find throughout that process was that what I had feared would be a very steep learning curve was not as steep as I had feared with people, and that it was to some degree for many people intuitive. I went to many events, where we were explaining this process to the voters and explaining that to folks, and the reception was positive and was reflected in the votes that fall. And so I'm very pleased as we're moving forward as a city to have this as a tool and to have this as a way to deepen democracy in the City of Minneapolis for our municipal elections. So I will turn you over to the capable hands of our of Ms. Reichert, who can answer any questions you have about what's happening in Minneapolis regarding our voting system.
Thank you, Council Member. And Ms. Reichert, if you could state your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Reichert. I'm Director of Elections for the City of Minneapolis. I'm Senator Larson, members of the committee. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Well, when our charter amendment was passed, the ordinance actually calls for the City Council to develop an ordinance subsequent, which would include the ballot format and rules for counting the votes. Realized very early on that this was a large task, something that shouldn't be undertaken in a vacuum. We have election partners. Shortly after the passage of that charter amendment, we started working with Mark Ritchie to establish the Secretary of State's Ranked Choice Voting Issues Group. We've been meeting since June. Several meetings have taken place. And what we're trying to do in that group is to develop a set of standards, a set of rules, as you will, that would assist us in conducting the election. Minnesota election law is highly prescriptive. Every step we take along the way is laid out in statute and the rules created by the secretary. There are no rules presently for running ranked choice. So that's what we're working on, is develop those. And we also recognized right away that our opportunity here is to really take on a leadership role in the state, try to develop those standards that can be used statewide that would help other jurisdictions implement when they choose to do that, would also create standards for equipment developers to design toward. So that's what we're doing right now. The membership on this task force is very broad. We have a number of people in this room who've been attending our meetings. There are a lot of Minneapolis people. We do have a heavy Minneapolis contingent, but we're the pioneers, as Betsy said. So we're working together. The beauty of the process, I think, is that we do have everybody at the same table discussing the same issues, the same challenges and opportunities together. So it's a process that I think I was recently in San Francisco to talk to their election staff where they have implemented ranked choice, and they're very envious of the process that we have going here. So I wanted to thank everybody who's working with us on that. We have two subcommittees on the group that have been very active. The first is the Technical Advisory Committee. We started meeting in July, and what we did is spent every Monday morning for several weeks reading the statute and the rules word by word, trying to determine where the procedures that are currently contained in general election law might conflict with what we would need to do to run a ranked choice election. We did issue a report that's available on the City of Minneapolis website, and I believe there were copies available here, too, earlier in the meeting. Another subcommittee was subsequently developed, and that is the Legislation and Rules Committee. What we're doing on that committee, and several of us are on both of these committees, is to study the solutions to the conflicts, different options for rules that we want to adopt. And the intent is that we would like to introduce legislation early in 2008 that would specifically authorize Minnesota charter cities to use ranked choice for their municipal elections, and it'll also provide all of the rules and procedures that any cities would need to follow to conduct those elections. Another thing that the Technical Advisory Committee continues to work on is the issue of equipment. This is a problematic issue, and Joe Mansky from Ramsey County Elections will be talking a little bit more about the details of the equipment. I just wanted to mention that a lot of the issues that he'll be talking about in terms of Ramsey County and the cities that operate within Ramsey County, their equipment sharing agreements and things, those all apply in other counties and cities as well. In Minneapolis, for example, we do not own our own voting equipment. That is owned by Hennepin County. We're part of their system. All of the equipment in the state of Minnesota is required to be federally certified and certified by the state. A number of options that we're studying have been tried in other communities. For example, the Kerry Henderson that we just heard about. I think the difference that we need to recognize there is that those elections were not required to be conducted on equipment that is federally certified. In Minnesota, municipal elections do require federal certification for their equipment. We're however, looking at all of the options that are being put forward. Some of them are inexpensive temporary solutions. Others are the more permanent and more expensive solutions, a higher price tag, but more security with those, too. We do have really good cooperation going right now between all of the jurisdictions in the state, the Hennepin County, the State Elections Office, and of course the City of Minneapolis are working really closely. What we're trying to do is come up with a logical, cost-effective solution. Our mission really is to make sure that when we are ready to implement, this is going to be done right, and we don't want any false starts. There has been a number of problems in San Francisco where they've had a rocky road, perhaps transparent to the voters, but in terms of the administration of the election, they have had some issues there, which we've had the opportunity to learn from and frankly don't want to repeat. So at this point, when we talk about our timeline for implementation, it's not really clear yet whether we'll be able to do it in 2009 at our next municipal. That is what we are currently working toward, and we're working hard toward that. However, if we're not able to implement by then, our City Council does have the option to certify that we're not ready and we would be able to delay till 2013. That may allow us additional time and opportunity to work with the county to replace the county equipment system with something that's ranked choice compatible. At this point, still up in the air, but we're working toward it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Members have questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming forward and providing that testimony. I think, you know, we're going to see this debate broken down into a couple of different segments, and that is, you know, do we agree with the concept? And Senator Gerlach and I and others may fall in different places as it relates to that, and then should they be applied to local elections versus state elections? I think the discussion about, you know, if someone gets 45% of a vote, is that less valid than someone that gets 51 is different from the discussion of, I think, Mr. Gilbert told us the story about the judge that got 22% that was elected. You know, that's the part that gives me concern and makes me think about change. On the other hand, I think it is a different discussion as it relates to state races or statewide races, and I think that we're about to have a lot of that discussion over the next many years here in Minnesota. But we appreciate Minneapolis's efforts to do this very carefully, and everyone's watching and to see how this works, and I appreciate all your hard work. Thank you very much for your testimony, and we're going to hear from the Secretary of State's office, Beth Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beth Frazier. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office, and my testimony will be brief. Ms. Reichert described the issues group that we have convened and that has been meeting and the work that we've been doing. I guess I just have a few things I'd like to add. One is that we are really excited about the process and about being able to help charter cities that choose to use this voting method figure out how to make it work in a way that works for voters, that works for election administrators. And although we're not talking about statewide races, that treats voters equally across the state, even if they're voting in different municipal elections. We want to be sure that everyone is treated the same. The other issue is that this is a statewide issue. This is not a Minneapolis task force. This is not a Minneapolis issue. There are other charter cities that are examining this voting method. I know that the city of Red Wing is actively considering changing their charter to allow for ranked choice voting in runoff elections. The city of Hopkins has been studying this issue for a long, long time. And as we're discussing potential legislation and changes that would facilitate the use of ranked choice voting in the statute, we are, Minneapolis is at the table, but they're not the only voice at the table, and we are considering what other jurisdictions are interested in. The city of Hopkins, for example, is interested in a different type of method for multi-candidate races, and so that is part of the discussion, and any legislation that comes forward, I think, will account for that in one way or another. So I don't have much more to add. You have the report from the technical advisory group, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. That report is in members' packets, and if there are no questions, we'll move to our next testimony. Thank you, Ms. Frazier. I'm going to call next on Joe Mansky, who is the elections manager for Ramsey County and formerly has served in the office of the Secretary of State and has had a long career in elections and is here to provide some testimony. Next on the agenda list was former Senator John Hottinger, who I don't believe has arrived yet, and he hopefully will be joining us for testimony later in the hearing. Mr. Mansky, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the tape, this is Joe Mansky from the Ramsey County Election Office. And basically what I wanted to do this morning is just give you just a brief synopsis of some of the technical issues that surround the implementation of instant runoff voting, ranked voting, proportional voting, whatever you want to call this voting method. We have no position for or against this. We're prepared to implement whatever laws you pass. So having said that, I think as Ms. Reichert indicated earlier, all the voting equipment that we currently use in Minnesota was certified by the Secretary of State before it was contemplated that we would use a voting method other than first past the post, and that is whoever gets the most votes wins. That's how our voting equipment is currently programmed, and that's the only way that it works right now. For us to go to a different voting method, which is to say to do something other than just figuring out who got the most votes, that we would have to go to a different voting system. I have talked to the two vendors with which we do business, both of them indicated that they have new systems in development right now. They are not real close to having something that they can submit to the Election Assistance Commission in Washington to have tested against the federal standards, which is a statute requirement of ours that we don't have, for example, for our friends in North Carolina. We do require federal certification of their compliance with the federal standards as a condition of being certified for use in Minnesota. And as a result of all this, since we do not want to use a new voting system in a state election year, it's clear that we're not going to be able to have a system available in 2008, and I would suggest to you that we would not be in a position to use one in 2010 either, because even if a system was certified for use in 2009, I will tell you, just based on my personal experience, I would not use a new voting system in a state election year. So I think what I'm telling you is that you might want to contemplate using a new voting method for the first time in 2011 and in future election years. Second, here in Ramsey County and in St. Paul, where we're sitting today, we conduct our city and our school district elections concurrently. And I think, as you heard from some of the other testifiers, there is some interest on the part of a few charter cities in Minnesota to use their charter authority to enact one of these alternate voting methods. And the problem that we have with that from an administrative standpoint is that none of our school districts with whom we conduct our city elections concurrently have such authority. Neither do our suburban cities, which are, for the most part, statutory, and similarly do not have the authority on their own to adopt an alternate voting method. And as a result, my suggestion to you is that even though we probably could conduct on a single day using a single ballot and a single voting system an election where we have two different voting methods, where we would have, for example, the ranked voting for the city offices and then the first-past-the-post system for the school district offices, I cannot sit here in front of you and recommend that we ever conduct an election like that. And as a result, our preference would be that if you do want to see our charter cities have the ability to conduct an alternate method election, that you would want to enact a state law, in my view, that would allow our statutory cities and our school districts to do the same thing. It raises the issue also of what happens with the cities and school districts who conduct their elections in the even-numbered years along with the state elections. That actually is the majority of our cities, although most of our large cities are in the odd year. Most of our city elections are, in fact, in the even-numbered year, and you come up with that situation again if you choose not to extend the alternate voting to the state elections of having both methods occurring in one election on the same ballot. And my thought is that that probably is not the situation that we want to be in. Here in St. Paul, one of our barriers is that nearly a quarter of our population speak a language other than English at home. And it's not that we could not educate them properly and our election judges on how to conduct an election with two methods on the same day. I think I would prefer not to to have to be able to do that. The third issue is compiling the election results, and I think as Senator Gerlach has indicated that there are two different things going on here. First of all, our current voting equipment is perfectly capable of doing round one of any voting system that I think you're going to be looking at, and that is to determine on the first pass whether someone did or did not get 50% of the votes. That is something that we can do without any problem. What our equipment cannot do at the polling place is to reallocate those votes in a second, third, and subsequent round and determine citywide or countywide who actually got the first, second, or third greatest number of votes, and to be able to drop candidates and reallocate the votes from one round to another. As best I know, the only way to do that would be at a counting center, whether that is done manually, which obviously we could do today, or with a new set of voting equipment that might be available in future years. But I guess my point is that one of the things that we like about our voting equipment today is that 801, 802, 803, we have instant results going out on our website, and it does allow people to know immediately who won the election. Perhaps there is a way to do this reallocation through some network at our polling place level, which would be my preference. But if that's not the case, then we would have to set up a counting center and then go back to that location and start going through the reallocation of votes through subsequent rounds of voting. The fourth point I would like to make is on replacing the voting equipment. Here in Ramsey County, we have a joint powers agreement with all of our cities, and our cities technically actually own all of our voting equipment. The county bought the equipment. The cities then paid the county back for it. The county has the backup units, and then we cause all the ballots to be printed, and we program the system for every election. Other counties probably have similar arrangements, if not exactly the same arrangement that we have. And in any case, since we would have to replace our current equipment to go to the new voting method, it becomes a cost issue for all of us, frankly. When we bought our equipment in 2001, it was contemplated that the useful design life was probably going to be something on the order of 10 years, which is the other reason I am interested in the year 2011, because that would be year 10 of our existing voting equipment, and at that point, we would be looking to replace it with something else. So again, I would like to at least suggest to you that if you are looking for a logical implementation date, that you might want to look at the year 2011 to do that from the cost standpoint. And let me make a pitch, since we do have the state treasury account out there, we would be happy for any money that you would want to appropriate to that account that would allow us to buy any new voting equipment. I would be remiss if I did not take the opportunity to say that. And then finally, my last point, and I'm done talking for a while, is that I think, again, as Ms. Reichert and others have pointed out, our election law does not currently accommodate the many of the features of the ranked voting or proportional voting methods. And at a minimum, my suggestion to you would be to define the following things in state law. Number one, what is the maximum number of rounds that we would go through to determine a winner? Do you want to have 2 rounds, 3 rounds, 5 rounds, an unlimited number of rounds? Again, could be anything, but we just need to get some guidance from you on what to do there. Number two, we also need to know the maximum number of votes that you can cast. Can you vote for, if there are 10 candidates on the ballot, are you going to be permitted to vote for 2 candidates, 3 candidates, 5 candidates? Do you rank all the candidates? And again, we just need some direction there. Third, we would need some procedures for counting and compiling the votes at the counting center. And I should mention to you, we used to use counting centers when we had the punch card system and when we used to central count optical scan systems. We no longer do any of that, but we have some experience that we can draw on for those purposes. Number four, we need to get some rules that determine how we determine voter intent, again, based on how the ballot is being marked. And then number five, we would need some guidance from you on how we would conduct a recount in a ranked voting or a proportional voting election. And then the final point I would like to make is that I am aware that the Attorney General has reviewed this proposal or some proposal similar to that, and that the view of the Attorney General's office is that the ranked voting may well be unconstitutional in general elections. If that's the case, I think we would prefer to kind of know what your thought about that is sooner than later. And because not only does that affect, you know, how we are going to operate, but speaking as someone who is conducting an election in a charter city, I suspect that if the Attorney General's view is correct, it likely also constrains our ability to use our charter to conduct an election using this method. Having said all that, however, it does appear as though there may not be a constitutional issue with primaries. And if that is the case, it might be worthwhile for you to explore the possibility of restricting the use of the ranked voting or proportional voting just to primary elections. And again, if I can take the moment here to give a plug for the Grow Commission, who I staffed a number of years ago, that type of alternate voting method might coincide fairly well with a system where the political parties would endorse multiple candidates, that they would all go on the primary ballot as the gain ballot access as the party endorsed candidates, and then the primary voters would have an opportunity to rank the people that they would like to see go on as the party nominee. This method might also be useful if the legislature contemplates restoring a presidential primary sometime in the future, where that event would occur in February or March, and by the time you get to the party conventions in June or July or August, the whole playing field might well have changed, and there might well be some logic in allowing voters to be able to rank their choices early in the year so that the parties would have some guidance at their national nominating conventions.
Thank you, Mr. Mansky. As you know, there were some of us that made a little bit of an effort to try to revive a presidential primary during the last legislative session, although funds got in the way of us, so we didn't have the money to do that. But and as we enter that season, it'd certainly be very interesting, and it sounds like the parties are moving that up. I appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Mansky? Thank you, Mr. Mansky, very much. I guess I have one question for you before you go. You said that you've visited with some of the manufacturers, and it seems to me, as there's more discussion about ranked choice voting, that sort of the market fills that void. I mean, what can you tell us about your impressions of their ability to do that in the near future or intermediate future?
You know, Mr. Chairman, it's a great example of this chicken and egg situation. And given the fact that the vendors are in business to make money, they don't want to put a lot of effort into something that they can't make money on. And so what the vendors will tell us or have told us is, if you guys authorize this, we'll develop you a system. And, of course, from my standpoint, I'm not prepared to go to the county board or the city council or the school board, which are my three governing bodies here, unless we have a law in place that authorizes me to do that. And that seems to be the dilemma. The first step that we would like to see the vendors do is to get a system and submit it to the EAC so that it can be tested against the federal standards. I think if they were to do that, then I think that tells those of us who are on the end of the network that has to write the checks that we may well have a viable system. But I think, as I've told the vendors, and I'm meeting again with them in the next couple of weeks, that I'm just really reluctant to go to the board and the council lacking a bona fide system, which I know is certifiable by the Secretary of State.
Now, I know in fact, Mr. Gilbert testified in the Kerry circumstance that the use of the OptiScan was, and I presume the way that was used, and maybe you can nod, Mr. Gilbert, if this is correct, that you did run it through on the first choice, and then it was from there that you created your stacks. I remember you talking about
correct.
The stacks. And so, and Mr. Gilbert is confirming that.
We are federally certified. We're required by the state for the equipment to be federally certified, by the way.
Thank you. And Mr. Mansky, I presume that that system, if used here in Minnesota, would not jeopardize in any way the fact that we need certified machines, and yet we just have a more extensive way of counting the second round. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct. As at least for the systems that I am familiar with today, we can deal with the first round, and that is simply to determine whether somebody did clear the 50% hurdle. It is the subsequent rounds that our voting equipment is not programmed to handle, nor do we have any legal authority to do that. And that's where we're looking for a new generation of voting equipment that will be able to do just that. But if you wanted to enact a law where you indicated that on the first pass we would use the voting equipment, and then to conduct the subsequent rounds that we would have to go back and manually count the ballots at a counting center. From my standpoint, just from an administrative standpoint, we could make something like that work. To be honest with you, I prefer never to have to count ballots by hand, because I think I can demonstrate to your satisfaction, having done more legislative recounts than I care to remember, that the hand counting is the least accurate method of counting ballots that we have in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Mansky. Are there any further questions? Thank you again for your testimony. We are going to the next person on that has signed up to testify. And I apologize if I don't get your name right.
Senator Larson, former Senator Hottinger is here.
Very good. I think, in fact, I think what we're going to do is we're going to finish with a couple more folks and have Senator Hottinger kind of wrap up,
okay,
if Senator Hottinger is okay with that. Mr. Andy Selig.
Right.
Mr. Selig.
Right. Can I use the internet?
I don't think that that's set up for internet use, but
so I shouldn't try.
I wouldn't try it. No,
okay.
I don't think so.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
I think it's just
right.
It was set up for a previous PowerPoint.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Selig. I'm from the Minnesota Voters Alliance. I'm one of the co-founders, along with Matt Marchetti from North St. Paul and Professor Michael Degnan from University of St. Thomas, PhD in philosophy, and former professor of the year in 2004. But before I get started, I'll probably bounce around a little bit. We oppose instant runoff voting. We think it's a horrible thing for the voters. Barb Johnson on the Minneapolis City Council said that it's going to confuse a core group of senior citizens. What a horrible thing to do. That's what Barb Johnson said. But let me just keep going. I'm going to be quoting and throwing stuff out there. Please take what you can and, you know, leave the rest. It's all in arguments that we've studied for quite some time. But before I begin, I want to correct the gentleman, Mr. Gilbert, I believe, from North Carolina. It's not all rosy from North Carolina. The capital city of Raleigh, let me just read you a couple of quotes from the five council members. Dr. James West said, from Raleigh, "I have indicated that I have some concerns about this disenfranchising a certain segment of voters, especially those of lower socioeconomic level." Philip Isley, "I'm not going to support it. It feels a little un-American, frankly." Thomas Crowder, "Just like blackjack in Las Vegas, we are seeing a lot of gamesmanship trying to figure out the odds of putting people into office." Joyce Kakis, "It's a little un-American. I'm voting against it." Tommy Craven, "To me, it's something that would certainly serve the convenience of the Board of Elections, but certainly not in the best interest of the voting public." I want to correct Mr. Gilbert in one more sentence. He stated that in Cary, North Carolina, your second choice cannot hurt your first choice. I'm here to tell you folks that that's not true. They have a different situation than what's been passed here. They actually have the top two vote-getters advancing and all the second choices tabulated and going to just those two candidates. It's different than the single transferable vote here, so his statement is absolutely false. I want to correct Ms. Reichert, who said that the rules for counting have not been adopted yet. The ballot wording right here, "should the city adopt single transferable vote," sometimes known as instant runoff voting or instant runoff voting as the method of electing mayor and la-di-da-di-da. Single transferable vote, folks, is a specific type of rules for counting for preferential voting. I think they overlooked that here when they constructed the wording on the ballot. So I just want to correct that for the record, that the rules for counting have already been adopted. There's nothing to adopt by ordinance. By virtue of the fact that the voters voted for single transferable vote, that's a specific method developed by Thomas Hare in England in 1700s, which is on our website. But for the record, I just want to correct that. Now, I just want to focus on the main part, what I want to come here for, is the constitutionality. Our group is challenging. We plan to file a legal challenge as soon as December 4th, saying that the Minneapolis election for instant runoff voting is unconstitutional. We think that's a very, very doable thing. Our interest is actually bigger than that. We want to set a national precedent, but we'll see how that turns out. But I'm just going to touch the constitutional arguments, and then I'll wrap up. Proponents claim that IRV is constitutional, even though the 1915 Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Smallwood that preferential voting is contrary to the intent of the Constitution. They claim The ruling was not because it was preferential voting per se, but because it involved the Buckland method of counting, which had the effect of giving voters more than one vote. Proponents argue that IRV does not share this fatal flaw because in IRV, only one of each voter's rankings ends up counting, the one that is applied to the highest preferred candidate eligible to receive it. Our point is their argument fails to address the issue, folks. This is not about how votes are counted, transferred, and or otherwise manipulated. This is about how many votes each voter is allowed to cast. That's what the Supreme Court said, if I may. The state's highest court emphasized that the Constitution, by implication, forbids any elector from casting, that's the word I just want to make clear, casting more than a single expression of opinion or choice. You get one. That's what the highest court said in Minnesota. We believe that still stands today. IRV has a second fatal flaw. All ballots are not counted equally. The Star and Tribune says that we, who believe it's unconstitutional, suffer from a misunderstanding. All ballots are counted equally. That's absolutely false. While the Buckland method counts all secondary votes, for those of you who don't know what the Buckland method was back in Duluth in 1915, if no majority was reached, 51%, the computer went to everybody's second-choice votes and added them up. And all I'm saying is if you're going to count their second-choice votes, count mine. It's actually better than the current system today. So this means that some voters have their first and subsequent choices counted while others have only their first-choice votes counted. We have an example on our website, mnvoters.org. You can click it and open it up. And basically, if you have ABC candidates and one has 40, 35, and 25, basically it's going to throw C out, and it's going to count the second choices on only those 25 ballots that were cast for candidate C. So if 16 go to B and 9 go to A, B is declared the winner with 51%. So, and finally, IRV has a third fatal flaw, which we believe is the most important. In elections with more than three candidates, voters are placed in a precarious situation of not knowing whether or not their votes are going to help their cause or hurt their own cause. And I'll just touch on it briefly. I wanted to show it on the computer, but it's called the effect of non-monotonicity and preference truncation. And what it shows is, it sounds complicated. It was developed on New York University political scientists. It just gives a groups of voters here. And what it simply means is it shows an example of three voters who voted for D, where A ends up winning. If these three decided to vote for A, all of a sudden B wins. So, Senator Gerlach touched on this, and that's the problem of non-monotonicity, where the voters can walk in, and if I want A, how am I going to know that voting for D is the best way to get my candidate elected? It's absolutely insane. And also, the preference truncation simply means that if you vote for candidates below a certain level, you can end up coming back and hurting yourself. So I want to touch on the Attorney General letter real quick. The Attorney General said that if Brown is to be followed, IRV is probably unconstitutional. By the way, the city attorney, Assistant City Attorney in Minneapolis, Bert Osborne, said in January 3rd, said that he recommended against putting it on the ballot because it conflicted with Brown versus Smallwood. So not only do we have the Minnesota Supreme Court, I think, has agreed with us. That hasn't changed. That precedent is still alive. The Minneapolis City Attorney said you can't do it. And the Attorney General is saying, you know what, it's probably unconstitutional. I want to point to two things about this Attorney General report. She stated that the court was primarily concerned with an election format which placed voters in a situation where they could ultimately harm the cause of their favorite candidate, and that's exactly what single transferable vote does. The Attorney General laid out the differences between Buckland and single transferable vote, but she failed to acknowledge the harmful effects of single transferable vote due to non-monotonicity. If she had taken that into consideration, we believe she wouldn't have said that IRV is probably unconstitutional. She would have said that it is unconstitutional. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Seidlick. Any questions? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll continue my role as the committee questioner here. But I want to ask the question, I want to explore a little bit on this constitutionality part, because I want to understand that, and I mentioned at the very beginning, but then we didn't really get into it at all with any of the other testimony, and I want to make sure I understand that. Maybe Mr. Seidlick, if you could hold on a second, because
I'm ready.
Maybe want you to clarify this for me so I understand it. So
the constitutional, I've been reading through some of the documents here, and I understand there's it gets complicated in the sense that there's something called single transferable vote, and there's that somehow is different for some Buckland method and various things, and I don't have the time, the patience here right now to try to figure out the minutiae of that. But I want to understand here, because what I'm gathering is that in a runoff system, whatever the system is, you have people voting, and if your candidate if your candidate is not the lowest vote getter, but has not hit the majority, then they're sort of held, and then the lowest one is dropped off, and those votes and their second choices are then redistributed. So now, the person who voted for somebody that had enough votes to stay in the game, they're sort of done. I mean, they've cast their one expression, their one choice, their one vote. And then those who have cast a ballot for a losing candidate now get a second bite at the apple, so to speak. So now they have not only their vote, but they now they have another chance to influence the outcome. So now, as I'm gathering the constitutional argument, so you've got one group of people who've got one vote, one choice, one expression, they're done. And then you have other groups over here, depending on how the mechanics work out, they get second options, second bites at the apple to influence the outcome. I mean, isn't that skew the whole? I mean, isn't that what
right?
This
and
is
that's
exactly
right, Senator. Yeah, and that's exactly what the court said here. And let me touch on this right here. The last two quotes here from the Minnesota Supreme Court said the quotations made from the different cases are not chance expressions. They are indicative of the idea which permeates all legal thought that when a voter votes for the candidate of his choice, his vote must be counted one, and it cannot be defeated or its effect lessened except for the vote of another elector voting for one. Our further examination confirms us in our view. Our decision is sound. We do right in upholding the right of a citizen to cast a vote for the candidate of his choice unimpaired by second and additional choice votes cast by others. There's the whole part of our argument right there is the court preserved our right to do that, and that's what we're going to fight for.
Well, Senator Gerlach, and
tell me what I'm if I'm understanding.
Well, I mean, sure. The way you described it, you had four candidates.
Although I'd say it could be three.
Okay, let's say, but we'll say it was four, and you said that it seemed to me that you were describing the third group that was not in the top two but
whoever
had not
drops,
been eliminated yet.
Whoever drops.
Okay, the fourth candidate drops. That fourth candidate or that group of people or that group of voters could in fact go to the third place finisher, and that person maybe reaches a majority because of those dropped votes.
Well, good, Mr. Chairman, but they could also put the person who had the highest plurality over the top.
True.
As well, so you had one group that had two choices, two expressions of their vote, and you had other groups that had one and are sort of done. So you have some that get... That's what I'm saying is I think that's the crux of the constitutional issue is now you have some people that have second chances in the election, whereas others have one chance to influence
Mr. Chairman,
the
how does that differ
election.
From
Senator
a
Pappas.
Runoff election? It's just like combining a runoff and a original election because you'd have a second chance again to vote for the out of the top two. Like in a nonpartisan race for city council, you vote in the primary for your candidate, and then you go back and you vote in the general again. I don't really see the difference between doing it all at once and doing it in two separate.
Well, Senator Pappas, there's a huge difference. There's a huge
me,
difference,
Mr. Selig. It just happens that in we have rules in these meetings, and if everyone talks at once, it's impossible for us to
she should be
accomplish
corrected.
That. Mr. Selig, please. Please. I mean, we are very happy to have you here testify.
I apologize.
Like to follow the rules in the Minnesota Senate.
I apologize.
But if not, we would ask you to please step away from the podium. Senator Pappas, you were making your point.
Well, I think I finished, Mr. Chairman. I don't really see the difference between doing a runoff election and combining it into an instant runoff.
And I guess that's sort of how I feel about it is that not that nobody's getting a two votes is that somebody's getting somebody's vote essentially cancels because that candidate's out of the race and their vote isn't disenfranchised. Their vote is counted in who ultimately becomes the person that receives 50%. I certainly think that there's different ways to look at it, but that's sort of how I look at it is that when you have multiple candidates. It allows for the public at least to arrive at a better consensus on who should win that election by using the ranked choice system versus, as Senator Pappas mentions, us going to a more traditional runoff where the first two advance and then we put the state or the municipality or whoever the jurisdiction is through the additional cost and the voters through the additional burden of coming back to the polls altogether, in which they all would then have a second chance as well. Senator Gerlach. Well,
Mr. Chairman, in direct response to Senator Pappas, I think a difference between the instant runoff and the multiple bites of the apple, so speaking, compressing it, in a runoff, a regular runoff, a traditional runoff, everybody gets a second vote. See, you all vote, and then you have a result, and then the next time around, everybody gets to vote again. So everybody's votes are counted equally in both times. So that's a fundamental difference, I think, in what you're saying is, you know, when you put them together, you lose that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
With an instant runoff voting, everybody gets to have a second choice as well. So you don't really know if your second choice is going to be the vote that's counted or your first choice is going to be the vote that's counted. I agree that there's less, perhaps, information available to the voter if you combine them as opposed to having them separate. But I don't agree that some people get, you know, stronger or more effective votes than others do, because you both get a first choice and a second choice.
Mr. Chairman, I would say, what value is there in a vote that is not counted?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
Well, I think that's the problem with the current system, is that if people choose to vote for a third party or fourth party, in effect, their vote is not counted. And voters, I think, then make those decisions that, well, I know my vote is worthless and not going to be counted, so I guess I better vote for who I'm perceiving at this point are the top two vote-getters. So I think that's the problem with the current system, is it's not as democratic as it could be.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gerlach, did you?
Mr. Chairman, I would disagree that a vote for a candidate who does not prevail is not a wasted vote. It's counted of equal value as a vote for a candidate that prevails. I mean, a vote in the last gubernatorial election, our governor won with a plurality. A vote for Mike Hatch was of the same weight as a vote for Tim Pawlenty. Get some disagreement in the audience, but they were counted the same. Had there been other choices and somebody's were locked in and you only got your first vote and somebody else had multiple chances, those are at the weighting. It should be called a weighted voting system, not instant runoff voting. It should be called a weighted system because you have different people have different weights to their choice.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, you bring up another problem, is because Minnesota doesn't have a runoff election, that means that we are electing consistently plurality governors. Jesse Ventura was also elected as a plurality governor. And I think that makes our system less democratic because you don't really have the majority rule here. If you're down to two candidates, then you would have had a decision about whether Peter Hutchinson's votes would have gone to, in a runoff, would they have gone to Mike Hatch or would they have gone to Governor Pawlenty? Similar situation with the Ventura election. If Senator Humphrey was, the Attorney General Humphrey was the third vote-getter, would his people have voted for Coleman or Ventura? We don't really know because we didn't have an opportunity to do a runoff election to really come up with them. And I think that having a majority candidate, having majority candidates elected is important. It's an important part of democracy.
Yeah.
I think this debate is we're going to have this for a long time. And I think, you know, maybe what's at the crux of the debate ultimately will be, you know, whether we, you know, actually think about expanding this statewide elections, you know, in future years is going to be how much we value what Senator Pappas talks about as being the value of electing someone at 50% plus one.
Mr. Chairman, can I say one thing in closing?
Excuse me. We are actually running short on time, so we are going to, when I finish my remarks, we are going to move to the next testifier. But anyway, I think that we've had an interesting debate about it today and a discussion about it, and I think this is just the beginning, and a lot of interesting discussion. We also have, and Mr. Thea Seelig, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Fran Hesch from the Hopkins Charter Commission is our next testifier. Ms. Hesch, thank you, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Fran Hesch, and I am from Hopkins. I'm a Charter Commission member, a former City Council member. I chaired the Hopkins Alternative Voting Task Force that went on for an entire year, 2004 to 2005, and I currently am serving on the Secretary of State's Ranked Choice Voting Committee. I am a volunteer. I have not been paid for any of the work I've done. In fact, I have contributed to try to get to this point where we are exploring alternative voting methods at such a high level, and I'm very grateful to be here. I do have some documents that I did bring with. I won't go into them, but they're for your future reference. We had a 25-page alternative task force voting report, and I selected some of the highlights from that report and made some copies. Included in there were a list of individuals who participated on the task force, and it gives you an idea of the caliber of attendees and advisors who participated over that long-suffering period. Some of the background and the history on the task force, including the history of alternative voting in Hopkins and the chronology of the task force meetings, and then the various options, six different options that the task force ultimately suggested. And one of them went on as a recommendation to the Hopkins Charter Commission. A variation of that amendment is before the Hopkins City Council at the moment. And then also in the packet, I have a copy of my comments for today. And I would be happy to go into more detail with anyone at any time on these things, because it's very deep, and we have really had a lot of really beneficial discussions with council members, with citizens, with people from Fair Vote Minnesota, with other state people from other states. So I have two main reasons for testifying today. To state support for alternative voting methods being allowed for all jurisdictions in Minnesota eventually. And to document, the second part, believe it or not, is to document Hopkins' concern about the use of single transferable vote for multiple candidate, multiple seat elections in smaller cities. Regarding point number one, support of alternative voting method choice. Hopkins was the only city in the state to use an alternative voting method from 1947 to 1959, so that was well after the 1915 decision that we just heard about. Unfortunately, that method met its demise due to a lack of voter education, due to laborious hand counting without any machines at all at that time, and some political issues. So we want to do everything possible to avoid that same scenario again. More recently, in May of 2003, when Hopkins learned of the HAVA money being spent by the former Secretary of State of that office, Hopkins City Council was the first jurisdiction to pass a resolution encouraging the Secretary of State to purchase equipment that was ranked ballot voting compatible, and that resolution was used as a model for other cities. City Council also passed a resolution authorizing the creation of the task force. Currently, a charter amendment was placed on hold until this statewide situation becomes more clear. It contains language that would allow Hopkins to use instant runoff voting for single-seat elections, and also language for a voting method which simulates instant runoff voting, the counting method, for multiple-seat elections, which I agree with the last speaker is quite different than single transferable vote for multiple seats. And in fact, when he was mentioning you have too many votes, in single transferable vote for our needs, you don't have enough. You have one vote that distributes and fractionally distributes. Because of the complexity of our recommendation, the latter recommendation, our charter amendment would allow us to just use single seat counting, the IRV method for mayor and for special elections for council. And then wait and sever that from the multiple seat election if the equipment and the counting method becomes more clear. Regarding point number two, Hopkins' concerns about using single transferable vote for multiple seats. First I would like to say we support Minneapolis' effort, and we are, I am on the committee. The assistant city manager is on the Secretary of State's committee, and in larger cities, it is very possible that single transferable vote is the desired method. What it allows is a majority rule for single seat, but it also allows minority representation for multiple seat, and that's where you see the surplus votes being transferred and the fractional use of a vote. That did not work in our year-long discussions in Hopkins for us. People of the city of Hopkins that we have been before and have talked to, and the city council members, which incidentally it has to pass unanimously by a city council. It's not just a simple majority when you change the charter. A lot of the majority rule language is used and interchangeably, but it really only pertains to the instant runoff, the single seat. And that's what we were trying to accomplish with our method that it sounds similar to what they're doing in North Carolina for the multiple seat. So we do support Minneapolis to follow through on their voters' wishes to implement single transferable vote. For larger districts divided into wards where political parties have a great influence, STV can be a great option. We would really hopefully have you hear our voice when we say, please don't just legislate for plurality or the single transferable vote method. Because, you know, at this committee, we have decided to kind of table some of Hopkins' concerns because, you know, Minneapolis is the more urgent issue, and there does need to be some legislation to make that happen. What we really would want to stay away from would be to create any new language that would prohibit charter cities from implementing anything other than single transferable vote. My own personal view, and not speaking on behalf of all of Hopkins, but I just believe that if people want to preserve multiple votes for multiple seats, STV isn't going to work, and we need to find a different way. And really, I have to look more into the North Carolina method. But I think you will be posed with some language that tries to pigeonhole the multiple seat into the STV, the single transferable vote method. And I would just want to go on record now that we just hope that any language that you do pass, any statutes that you change, would not impact a choice of alternative voting for multiple seats. I am available for any kind of questions anytime. I've put my phone number and email address on the copy of my comments, and there's many, many people in Hopkins that would love to help out with voter education. And, in fact, we were going to do a mock election. We were all set to do a mock election until the Minneapolis vote passed, and then we put everything on hold. So that's one place where I disagree with Hopkins. I wish we would have gone forward with the mock election to see how this worked. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hesch. Questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And our next testifier believe final testifier is former Senator John Hottinger, who we're delighted to have with us today. And Senator Hottinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and member. I appreciate the chance to be – oh, members. Welcome back, Senator Gerlach. I appreciate the opportunity to present here today because I was a member of this committee or subcommittee, as the case may be, for about 4 years and have continued to be involved and interested in election issues. I could, because I know you want the testimony to be brief and not repetitive, just endorse the testimony of Ms. Massey, who I wasn't even here for, but I have so much confidence in, and the comments of Senator Pappas. Because I think she raised the issue that Senator Gerlach raised, I think she combated effectively. But let me add one other point to that discussion, and that was that in the second round of counting in a instant runoff or a choice, ranked choice situation, you do count both votes twice. No one is disregarding their vote. The people who voted for – you just don't have to come back to the polls again. Because whoever voted for number one or number two or number three, if there are four candidates, their votes are continued to count in the runoff. I don't want to get into constitutional issues because I think, I don't know if David Schultz testified, but he's amply discussed the issue of constitutionality at a number of forums and also, I think, in some op-ed pieces. But you're going to have continued discussions on that, I know, as you go along. I wasn't an instant believer in instant runoff voting. Senator Marty, I think, initiated the key discussions in the Senate, I was skeptical. Over time, however, I've become very supportive of the concept of ranked choice voting. And my experience as a first-time full-term voter in St. Paul this year, going through a primary and then a general election dramatically confirmed my support for having one election that ends up with a majority winner. And that's the process that we're using if we use, and I'm going to keep saying instant runoff voting because that's what I've gotten used to. And a caveat, I'm working on trying to implement instant runoff voting in Minneapolis, and like Ms. Hesch, I'm not getting paid. In fact, I'm contributing to the cause financially, so I'm not here as a paid advocate in any sense. But the situation in St. Paul really has confirmed it, and let me, instead of going at length about a piece I wrote, if you go to the website for Fair Vote Minnesota, there's a link to something called Low Voter Turnout Makes the Case for IRV, and I wrote that. But let me kind of go through the first paragraph of that statement. And it's written in more of a narrative form, so I'll present it that way. On the day of the St. Paul City primary, I walked into my precinct voting place and marveled at the quiet and peaceful solitude. Standing in a line of one, I picked up my ballot, went to my voting booth, my privacy protected by barriers and the fact there was no one else in the adjoining voting booths, and carefully cast my single vote. With my footsteps echoing in the virtually deserted auditorium, I went over and placed my ballot in the machine and then chatted briefly with the amiable election judges who were happy to have some company, albeit brief. I left pleased at having done my civic duty and irked that some potentially good people seeking city council seats might lose in what could only feebly be described as a reflection of democracy. In essence, my support for instant runoff voting is because it truly implements the concept of democracy where every vote counts, and it truly implements one of the key things that we're trying to accomplish in a democracy, which is voter support for a victor who has at least a majority of the votes. Minnesota has an increasing history of people getting elected to public office on less than a majority. Instant runoff voting, ranked voting, will help alleviate that concern. And it is a real concern. I'll be very frank. In the last gubernatorial election, I had gotten to know Peter Hutchinson for a long time and appeared at a couple of forums with him, and I had a lot of confidence that he could be a good governor. But I told him, listen, I'm not going to waste my vote, because you're not going to win. There's no mechanism that allows you to win, even if a majority of Minnesotans might support your point of view. Because if I vote for you, in essence, that'll be a vote helping a candidate who I don't want to win. So I made a strategic voting decision because there wasn't an opportunity that I might have availed myself to vote for Mr. Hutchinson. That strategic decision was to vote against Governor Pawlenty because I disagree with him on issues. And that is not a reflection of democracy or a reflection of the concept that the candidate who is supported by most of the people is the ultimate winner in an election. I believe from what I've done, and again, I don't want to be repetitive, so I'll try and keep it very brief, that the adoption of a ranked system would result in improved voter turnout, and there's certainly empirical evidence that that's what's happened in cities that have used it, but involved, maybe most importantly, an improved voter confidence in the outcomes of elections. There's always going to be discontent when someone wins, like Governor Ventura did with 37%, or as most of our governors have, at least since Arnie Carlson, well, I guess that's only Governor Pawlenty, who have won with less than 50%. It doesn't give that kind of confidence in governing that we need to have. However, people who win with less than a majority, and there have been a whole bunch of them, seem to serve as if they have a mandate. But let's go back to the St. Paul election and just put that in perspective. The primary, roughly 5% of the people made the decision choosing who the final two candidates would be. Less than 5% of the people. Using my ward as an example, the person who won in my ward in the primary had less than 50%. And if you compare it to the amount of registered voters in my ward, he got something like 2% of the registered voters because the turnouts were so poor. Even in the general election in St. Paul, unfortunately, the turnout was poor. And in my ward, the person who prevailed had something like 53%. So when so few people are so disengaged in the system, in significant part because there are only two, or because there are two elections instead of one, we all lose. democracy is not served well. What's evolved, I think, from my observations, and that's all they are. I'm not representing anyone else here, although I'm teaching Introduction to American Government this year and also Comparative State Government down in Mankato, where now I commute to Mankato. I've talked to those students, and I spoke to students at, I think it was 15 universities in the spring of 2006, universities and colleges around Minnesota. And it was nonpartisan, and it wasn't really me. It was they wanted to have a legislator come and talk about civic engagement and how to get involved and how to turn out people to vote. What I've learned is the great frustrations people have that we're electing people with 40% or 42%, or that we have primaries and general elections where we discount people who can't be in the top two because we don't have a mechanism to give true respect to the point of view they come forward with. And that frustration is harming the very active efforts to increase Minnesota's voter turnout. Now, we're tops in the country. That's wonderful. But in so many elections, when the first round of decisions are made, we have very small turnouts. Again, the St. Paul election is a perfect example of that. It seems that in order to improve turnout and in order to get more confidence in the public system and to provide a mechanism that let all votes truly count in seeking a majority winner, there are two things that need to be done. We have to open up the opportunities for people to vote by capturing the interest of voters and enhancing the opportunities of all voters. Instant runoff voting is likely to provide a more balanced discussion of issues because no one has to make strategic decisions about who their opponent is. No one has to do the negative campaigning against their key opponent, because what will happen is we'll have a discussion where what counts is your vote, and it will make sure that you participate in the election of a majority. That's been taking place with some encouraging registration efforts, some better and more substantive campaign coverage by media, which still needs to be improved greatly, and by making it easier, not more restrictive, to exercise voting rights. But the second thing that I've found from my observations among young people, and also that I feel is pretty essential to the concept of democracy, is finding a mechanism of voting so that elected candidates actually end up with 50% of the vote, and that those elected candidates include all of those candidates who should be considered for that decision. There are many reasons to talk about, or there are many reasons to use this kind of voting, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but I understand that since this is the beginning of part of an information process, you'll be looking at other resources. And certainly fairvoteminnesota.org is one of those resources that raises the technical questions, that raises the substantive rationale, and that answers questions about how best to serve voters and to serve a public democracy. So I would urge you to go there. Let me just finalize with five reasons. The adoption of ranked voting gives the opportunity for more majority, or for a finding of majority support, which is the essence of free elections. Majority support gives legitimacy to an elected official because he or she comes forward through an election process that results in a majority level of support. It allows voters to vote for their top choice without wasting their ballot, and we hear that argument every time we have three or more candidates up for election. And one very realistic concept is the cost. This is a low turnout. Primaries are costly and accomplish little if less than 2% of the electorate supports a candidate. Compressing, and I think I heard Senator Gerlach use that word, and I think it's a good word, compressing multiple elections into one so that we can have an orderly process to bring about democratic outcomes is a valuable goal and one that should be pursued. Again, I could go on for an hour if you want, but I don't think you do. But the rationale and the reasons for this improvement on the democratic process are contained quite precisely at the Fair Vote website. Thank you. I appreciate the chance to be here.
Thank you, Senator Hottinger. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of your testimony, Senator Hottinger. Did you talk about this constitutional issue at all from the Attorney General? I didn't quite understand it, and I wasn't real impressed if the court case was from 1915, because I think that's almost 100 years ago and circumstances change.
Senator Hottinger.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the highlights of the beginning of my testimony were that I said I confirmed what you said and I would just sit down. But
that's why
the fact that it's almost
100 years. You didn't in fact say that, Senator Pappas. Yes.
Yes, that was not just for your interest. That's actually what I said. I didn't get into the constitutional issues. I pointed out that Professor David Schultz from Hamline has done a very extensive analysis of that, and as Senator Gerlach indicated, the Attorney General's opinion that has been relied on was not precise and not final. She didn't indicate that it was definitely unconstitutional. But I think the concept, you raised part of it, Senator Pappas, is that your votes are counted. Your votes are counted whether or not you have to come there twice, as happens now, or whether or not during the second round of counting, your vote is counted again. So if you're voting for candidate A, when that redistribution takes place, you're still voting for candidate A. Your vote is being counted. So I think that that's a pretty persuasive argument to deal with the constitutional issue.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, we're not talking about any U.S. constitutional issue at all because there's instant runoff voting in other states. So this is just something that some little tweak in the Minnesota Constitution.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I haven't read the earlier decision, nor have I done much of a study in the constitutionality of the issue because I rely on Professor Schultz, and I heard him give a good explanation. But it appears that, yes, you're absolutely correct. There's no federal constitutional issue that has been decided adverse to this approach to counting.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Senator Hottinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the chance to be here. Good to see you all.
Thank you very much. And we have reached the end of the time that we have allotted for our committee. And I want to thank staff as well for all your work in pulling this hearing together. Also want to announce to the public that this hearing is being podcast. And so if you are interested in listening to this or letting other folks know who weren't able to attend, they should go to the Minnesota Senate website to the audio video section to access the podcast. Thank you again. There being no further business before the committee, the subcommittee, we are adjourned.
So where's the chairman taking us to lunch?
Will he help to check with her?
We were talking about the full committee, right?
Where are you taking me to lunch now?
I wish I'd have thought of that. Gosh, you did.